Oh yeah, I mean it's just a technique, and that's the way I put it. You know, I say Andy Fisher, he does it this way. This is my technique, and it's proven to be better.
That's good.
You know, but I just put it that way, and you know, I let them choose.
Yeah. it goes your way every time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but I'm the one grading them, so you know, so.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. And today I'm with Andrew Fisher, and we are going to talk about setting up a walking blood bank while you're downrange. Thank you for Andy for coming on the podcast again.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm going to kind of cut down to the chase. You know, everybody talks about, you know, a set up a walking blood bank, you know, just go ahead and do this, go ahead and do that. I'm not really seeing a lot of people actually practice setting up a walking blood bank or doing more than, you know, one transfusion, one collection and one transfusion, other than, you know, as a class together, you know what I mean? Not working together like you would have to do in a walking blood bank, you know, a collection, like a scenario. So if you wouldn't mind walking through, how exactly are you supposed to set up a walking blood bank? You know, and I'm talking about at a fob or a base.
Yeah. I don't know if there's one exact way to do it or the perfect way to do it. I think it probably has to be like a lot of things in the military medicine. You kind of have to adapt it to your specific needs and then go from there. I think probably the best thing to do would be, as we discussed in the damage control resuscitation podcast, that our preferred type of blood that we want to transfuse is low titer O whole blood. Now that's becoming more prevalent across you know, special operations and across conventional forces. While that may not be available for everyone, what you could do, which is pretty easy to do, is to do ABO testing for everyone assigned. So that's not something that cost a significant amount of money, and that is something that is available to pretty much every unit that I can think of. I'm sure someone out there will chime in and say that, you know, they can't get it done. But I think far and wide, for the most part, you should be able to get ABO testing done on all your donors. I think once you identify those donors, as we talked last time, you know, is it A for A? Is it O for O? And I think that's something that should be discussed as a part of the, you know, kind of the risk management, risk versus benefit sort of discussion when deciding how you're going to approach this walking blood bank. I think that at least identifying all your O's is probably preferential. And you can do a initial screening through something like MedPros. You should be able to pull up some of what their initial ABO is. You know, we started out doing two ABOs just to make sure that there was no mistake in that. And obviously, you know, can you be 100% sure that this is their blood group based upon two ABOs? I guess, suppose you can never be 100% on anything, but that gives us as close as I think we feel comfortable and say, yes, this is their ABO. Once you establish that roster, you can obviously carry that forward and it can be distributed to key leaders and to medical personnel. And that's probably the best way to initially go about it as far as identifying your donors.
If I can interrupt you real quick, and are you talking about blood typing through SRC, or are you talking about blood typing like through an Eldon card?
Through like a SRC through one of the labs before deploying. Yeah, I think that's a good option. I don't see that as being too much of a strain on the system, especially if you've pre-identified maybe your O donors to be able to then just confirm that they are O.
I know the DHA is now, you know, in charge of all DoD medicine, and I know they're putting a lot of energy and force behind blood typing, blood transfusions. So I think the availability and the ease of setting the system up is probably going to just become easier and easier as time goes on.
And I think so too. I think we'll probably see the point to where, you know, maybe testing for low titer may be kind of the norm, and we'll kind of have that going forward, and everyone will be identified, you know, once they come in, right? And that, I think that would be optimal, is if we could identify all our low titer donors upon entry into the military. Go ahead.
Because we've all heard of the horror stories of the blood type on the dog tags, just because there's so many people coming through the MEP stations, you know, their vials getting mixed up. So definitely always you want secondary confirmation, just making sure that they're correct.
Yeah, I think they're probably, at least the, you know, the ones you were issued, I think those are probably more correct than we probably give them credit for. The problem is how many people keep those initial, you know, sets that's issued by the military. You know, you can go out and get a set made and put anything on there if you want. So that becomes a problem, is people going out and just making their own dog tags I don't quite remember what I was, but I think I'm this, and they put it on there, and it could be completely wrong.
Obviously, you know, blood typing my team, my experiences through special forces, that's only 12 guys I have to worry about. That's not difficult. I'm sure the Rangers or Civil Affairs and everybody else is probably very similar, that a unit will go in there, get their blood types done. Now, we have our own system through SRC. When you're downrange, you know, either you're working with indigenous forces, conventional forces, foreign forces, other coalition forces, who may or may not have done the same thing. So, you know, in order to integrate them into this now system, because we're all going to be in this one place for a significant period of time and they're going to have to depend on each other, do you think using an Eldon card is safe enough for setting up a walking blood bank?
I mean, if you look at what they've done in the past, they certainly say it's a reliable means to identify someone's blood type or blood group. I think in times of extremis and those very high stressful times, I think it can pose a little bit of an issue. Now, if you're doing an Eldon card, hey, let's all everyone gather around. Hey, here we are. This is our, we just maybe arrived in country, and this is who we're going to be working with, and we don't have ABO on some people, then maybe we can simply, at that time do an Eldon card under a no stress situation and help identify donors. Then I think that's probably the time that they say, hey, these are pretty accurate based upon that. Not in the times when, I have, multiple casualties and I have to, I'm trying to identify someone so I can get a unit of blood. I think that's just failing to plan. So I believe if you do it in the right situation and right circumstances, it can be reliable.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the crux of the issue is people, you know, they write out their plan, they talk out their plan. You know, if this situation's happened, we're going to go do this. But they don't actually take those next steps and actually prepare for an event to happen. You know, and if you're on a fire base and you're having to call in any available person to come donate blood, that's a bad day. And it's chaotic enough as it is. That being said, if you had done pre-planning, you had done pre-testing of people, you reduce that stress level because you already know who it is you want and have hopefully communicated with those people, hey, when this alarm sounds or this signal goes over the PA, you are supposed to come to, you know, whatever location so that we can now begin donation.
Yeah. And I think a lot of places have been very successful in the deployed setting by setting up these walking blood banks and really putting some effort into practicing. You know, certainly you can, besides the Eldon card, you know, if you're in a deployed setting, you may have a lab option to be able to confirm that ABO. And I don't think any lab facility would necessarily frown upon saying, hey, we're trying to prepare for any sort of mass casualty situation or situation where we may need to start a walking blood bank. And so, like I said, there have been facilities from, say, you know, all the way down to small unit, like maybe an ODA, all the way up to, you know, like a Role 2, Role 3s that implement these walking blood bank protocols that have identified their donors. Once they get in country, they've been able to identify the donors. So, I don't think simply because you don't get it done before deploying that you can't necessarily still implement a good program overseas.
Now, let's say our testing is done. You know, we thought ahead, okay, we're going to get the entire fire base or whatever base we're at. We're going to get everybody tested so we know who's who. What kind of supplies are you going to need to prepare for? How many, you know, things like that? Because, I mean, you don't want, you know, entire connexes full of blood bags that are going to go bad, but you want to have enough ready to go in case you need them. So how do you like logistically plan for something like that?
Man, that's kind of a tough one, and I'm not sure there's an exact answer for it. I if you look at the different types of blood collection bags and how they come, you have the two major ones that I've seen within the DoD are the Fenwall and the Terumo bags. The Fenwall bags are the one that we see in these commercial kits that we get for the use of the point of entry. They come in that foil packaging, that single foil packaging, versus when you maybe get a Terumo bag, they may come in a package of 10. And they're more have more issues with temperature fluctuation and so they have to be a little bit more controlled than what you would see with the Fenwall bags. So I think, you know, if you have some sort of refrigeration or some sort of ability to maintain a little bit of supply, cold chain custody, and this isn't a cold chain custody issue. It's more like you kind of need to have something in place, you know, where do I keep my immunizations, that sort of stuff. So yeah, maybe I can take these Terumo bags and, you know, a couple stacks of them, I can keep them inside of this, inside of a refrigerator. Then you got the Fenwall bags. You know, I think you can just order those, right? And I think sometimes we probably maybe don't do ourselves justice financially by ordering a whole bunch of these fresh whole blood transfusion kits. I think you could probably order a lot of this stuff in bulk and then make it work for you. So, you know, yeah, if I could order 25 whole blood collection kits, that would probably be more than ample amount for what we're talking about in these small, more smaller unit prolonged field prolonged field care situations.
Yeah, I mean, the key, I think, you know, comes down to logistics. You know, well, how dangerous is your mission? How many casualties do you expect to get? And then pre-positioning the supplies to be able to handle it in the right places, so that you're not necessarily carrying it around with you or, you know, encumbered by it. But you know that if you need it, you have a small supply to last you until you can get the big supply to come in. But again, it always comes down to planning and coordinating.
Yeah. And I think at the point of injury, so if I'm at the point of injury and then say I'm out there with a platoon, you know, if I'm carrying, you know, three kits, and I really do kind of strip some of the stuff down. Like I said, the commercial kits are very big and bulky and it's hard to carry. If I have already pre-identified my donors and I've practiced, you know, doing fresh whole blood transfusions before going over, and I feel familiar enough with the practice of collecting blood and transfusing blood, I can, you know, fix, you know, 3 to 5 fresh whole blood transfusion kits and the size that many of the larger commercial ones may come in. And so if I do that and I'm out there with another medic who has also 3 to 5 kits, and maybe any donors that I have pre-identified that may carry one for themselves, then we are probably way more than we could ever use at the point of injury. And that's strictly from that point of injury standpoint. And so outside of that, maybe that whole blood, that collection bag, you know, other things that you're really going to have, is you may want to think about carrying an extra IV set for your donor, which, you know, your donors could carry with them. And, would you need some sort of point of care disease testing kit? Now that depends on, you know, your donor pool. So if I have pre-identified my donors and I know them, then I won't need it. However, if I'm having to rely on a host nation person and I'm going to have to use their blood to transfuse into one of our guys, which, you know, from what I'm aware has happened, then I want to probably have some sort of point of care testing kit. I think other things obviously you're going to need is, white tubing. You probably, if you're going to be transfusing like low titer O whole blood or, you know, maybe one type. So if I'm just going to be transfusing O blood, I'm not sure how many times you're going to switch out that transfusion or the administration set. But, you know, you could probably push a few units through there before you're going to have to change out that administration set. Are you going to need things obviously like op sites, Kelly's? And you got to think about it. I don't need to have all this for one kit, for each kit, but I need to be able to have enough stuff on me to be able to maybe run two fresh whole blood draws at one time. Yeah, I don't know what is your thought on that? I guess I like hearing your input.
Right. Well, the way I guess I like to carry it or think about it, as far as in the field transfusion kits, I might have one or two, but I definitely want my teammates to be carrying one for themselves. They just stick it under their plates. It's not heavy. It's not uncomfortable for them to have it under their plates, but it keeps very important equipment spread out in a team so that, you know, God forbid, I am the one that actually gets wounded or killed, you know, that equipment wasn't on me so that it won't be destroyed. You know, that the other medics or anybody else who knows any kind of medicine, they have access to things that hopefully would save my life or they save their own lives. So I like to think about that possibility and try and distribute the load as best I can if I can convince the guys to actually carry it. But as far as, you know, things like Kelly's and a Firebase, you know, I don't make kits. I make kits for things that I guess belong in a kit, or they belong together. So I would tape those things together, like the bag and the Y tubing. They're going together no matter what. So I would keep those things tied together. But as far as, you know, I like to do the more ruggedized IV with 18 gauge and a flush, or in a saline lock. I like to do that just because, one, it's super easy to teach people how to do it. They're already used to using an 18 gauge versus the 14, or yeah, it's a 14 gauge hard needle. So all those, I try to keep things the same as far as training goes, so they're comfortable doing that, and I can teach that person to give, you know, blood through it. I can teach them to give crystalloids or colloids or whatever I want, and the actual stick itself is exactly the same. So I can tell somebody, okay, go do that. They know what to do. There's nothing different. So things like that involve the actual IV, the stick, those go together. Things that involve blood collection, as far as the collection bag, Y-tubing, saline, if you're going to use the saline to flush the line, all those things go together. That's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think I tend to, if I just have if I have donors out there, I just have a unit of blood or I just need to kind of get a unit of blood from them. I don't usually attach an admin set to that. I kind of leave that up to me, but that's definitely a technique. I think what I probably failed to mention too, with the, if you kind of have to use that point of care testing due to maybe using host nation, I think it's probably, you know, although we see these blood tubes that come in a lot of these commercial kits, I think that's probably actually a good time to collect the blood. So, you know, we certainly want to be able to, if you can collect the blood from your donor and, you know, and from your patient. But we know how that works, and that's very difficult to do, I think, at least from the point of injury standpoint. I think if we're looking from more of a at a Firebase or, you know, some sort of fixed facilities type setting, then it becomes a lot easier to do. And I think overall the process should be a lot easier as long as you've kind of maybe practiced it a little bit.
Ultimately, it's going to have to come down to just practicing. You know, I think another benefit, now that I'm pushing my IV technique to having the saline lock, is just like you said, blood testing. You know, it's all through the same thing. I can hook up my, you know, my purple top through the collection and stick it through the PRN adapter and get a unit or, get a vial of blood and then start my collection versus doing multiple pokes in hopefully or probably a very stressful situation as it is. Just making it a lot more straightforward.
Well, you know, some of those Terumo bags, and I'm sure Fenwell probably makes them too, but, you know, they make it so they have a little port off of the donation line.
Right. Yes, that's very true. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. So, yeah, definitely. I think that's probably important, is understanding your equipment and knowing what you have to operate with in whatever situation you might find yourself, so you can execute as quickly as possible without kind of having to fumble over everything.
Another part of that blood donation is the questionnaire sheet. Is that something that you would just get done either pre-deployment or as soon as you got, you know, decided to set this program up, just to get everybody's information from the beginning, so you don't have to worry about, you know, filling out a questionnaire when people are dying. Would you set it up that way, or is that something that you have to get, you know, in a very timely manner or very close to the donation time?
So the on-screen donor procedures really is kind of that. It's for people that you haven't previously encountered, and you really don't know who you're working with. If you are in a deployed setting, you shouldn't have to use this sort of screening process in order to identify people. You should be able to walk people through the traditional screening process in a no stress situation in order to identify who your donors are. This really is sort of like, hey, we're kind of out here. I'm kind of end up with people that I don't really know. And here, let me go ahead and kind of use this as a way to kind of, you know, analyze the risk benefit of these different donors.
A quick aside to that, do you know if that donation card, if they make them in multiple languages?
You know, I don't know. So what we did was it's a proposed field emergency donor panel questionnaire and triage tool. So this was published, you know, from some of the people a part of Thor, and came out in the Transfusion Journal supplement for the 2016 RDCR Symposium. We did not specifically make one for the CPG. And I'm not sure, I can't remember if Transfusion offers it in a different language. But so I think you could probably replicate it in a different language, and that would probably, it'd probably help you out.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting those pre-made definitely would be key if you're working with, local nationals or other coalition forces that may not necessarily speak English. So, we've talked about pre-screening. We talked about getting guys getting typed and cross-matched. We talked about having our gear prepared. I think one really important thing is, how would you actually go and, I guess, coordinate with multiple units? You know, how do I go to a commander and convince him I need to get all of your guys tested, getting their blood so I can do a walking blood bank? How do I convey that risk benefit to them?
When you're deployed or before deploying?
Yep. This would be, I'm already downrange. My team would have been already taken care of, but now I'm convincing, a commander of another, unit that may or may not be spun up with the whole blood program. How do I convince that person that this is a good idea?
I think you can do it simply by explaining that this practice has been utilized for, 100 years. We've been doing fresh whole blood transfusions, right? So it's a practice that has been associated with mass casualty and combat trauma for a significantly long time. And specifically, in the last, since 9/11, that it has been used multiple times. There's been over 10,000 units transfused. And, if you want to, you can simply state, we have information, we have publications and studies that demonstrate that fresh whole blood is superior to anything else, that this doesn't. And then maybe you wanted to talk about how, this program doesn't take away from the commander's capabilities, doesn't take away from what he's able to do, doesn't necessarily take his soldiers or his service members out of play because they decided to donate a unit of blood. But at the same time, it's kind of up to him or her, how they choose to you know, utilize their service members once they're done with donation. Maybe explain that this benefit is not only for, you know, what you plan on using it for, but also for the commander. Hey, we're here to support you at the same time. So if something happens, we can help you. And you know, this is a mutually, oh crap. Sorry. I lost my words there. Let me start all over. Let me start all over. So you can explain to the commander that this program will benefit both units. So this isn't about, you know, my unit and me just wanting to have your donors participate to help me. This could very well benefit that unit, and the commander should understand that you're there to do what you can across the board to ensure that each unit is supporting each other in the best way possible. And if you have the capability to transfuse fresh whole blood and they don't, then I would hope they could at least understand that. And if they don't, you know, maybe you could go to their medical people to kind of help translate why this is an important part of, you know, military medicine and treating severely wounded service members.
Right. It always comes down to communication and just getting people to at least try and see that, you know, there is a real benefit. Okay. This has been done for, you know, over 100 years. It's very safe, and the risk benefit, you know, very low risk, very great benefit. And just kind of, I guess, you know, breaking it down very simply, I think, can get through to their guys. If we do this program, more of them are going to live than if we don't.
And I think it's probably important to explain that, it is a very safe program. And it's more safe if we kind of do it beforehand and help identify those donors before, because in the heat of, you know, battle or, you know, the mass casualty event or whatever, that's not really the time to try to identify, you know, who is going to be able to donate blood. And I think most commanders, most, you know, maneuver commanders and such probably understand the importance of, you know, planning and helping to identify those issues beforehand. And then so if it does come up, you can address it and you already have something in place.
I'm sure you've run one or two walking blood banks before. How long, you know, from the time that of need to the time that you're actually getting your first units of blood, how much time have you seen that take? Roughly,
it depends on where you are. I think if you're in a more close knit setting, point of injury type setting, that should be able to get done within 20 minutes. Now that should be blood collection. Now how do you identify your donors and they come forward? Hopefully, you have that set in place to where it's, you know, they're already identifiable. I've not been a part of big one on like a FOB, but have kind of witnessed it. And, you know, once that call goes out, you know, they come running. Now they do, I think they tend to do a little bit more testing and a little bit more careful about their procedures in those large facilities. But as you and I know, is, you know, in the more pre-hospital setting, often we do not have the opportunity due to manpower or time to go through every process that they may go through. So our goal, I think, from our perspective, you should be able to have a unit going within 30 minutes. I think that's a realistic goal.
Right. You know, and as in what you're mentioning about testing, I think in that way, you know, in the field, pre-hospital, it's almost easier because you don't have 20 people in line doing their Elden cards, where you can easily get these things mixed up versus in the field. I have two guys, laying in the prone, getting their blood drawn, John and Steve. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get those things screwed up.
Right. I have a list here, and it says, I have the 10 names of the people who can donate, and two of them, John and Steve, are right here with me. Yeah. And I know that they're my universal donors, or they're, the accepted, whole universal donors that I'm willing to accept risk for in this situation. Say if you don't have them low titer, but hey, I know they're O donors and I'm willing to accept that risk.
Yeah. No, I think it's important just to keep in when you're training. Yes, you're trying to get the times down, but also just for planning. From the time I call it to the time I get that full bag in my hand, how much time is that? You need that for planning so that you can understand, okay, I have 20 minutes that I'm not going to have blood on board. So I'm going to have to sustain this guy until that time. I actually have this resuscitation actually starting. Underestimate how long it actually takes. I've had many, many students tell me I can get this done in like 7 minutes. And each time I'm tempted to bet them, $50 says you can't get it under 10 minutes. Cause I'm pretty good at, keep paying attention to how long it actually has been taking. 20 minutes. I've seen 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, in these training scenarios where just maybe in a classroom drawing blood, and yeah, I've seen it. You could fill a bag in 5 minutes, but that's not realistic. It's great that you can feel challenged in that sort of setting and do it really fast. I feel better about you consistently being able to pull a unit off in 10 minutes or 15 minutes versus, inconsistently being able to do it in 5 versus 25. And I'll be honest with what I've been teaching for these fresh old blood transfusion classes. And this is based upon something I read from, out of like the Army blood program and donation that, if it's taken more than 15 minutes to fill a bag, so once I initiate and it's taken more than 15 minutes, you probably need to think about DCing that donation, because it's just you may have some sort of stagnation in the line, maybe some clots in the line or something like that that is essentially may never fill, and you're sitting there kind of going back and forth, waiting on it, waiting on it, waiting on it. If it's not full. Within probably 15 minutes of you actually initiating that line, I'd probably seriously consider moving on to another donor.
Yeah, I think it also kind of goes with that adage, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Guys get in a rush, and the most tenuous point of that whole collection is the stick itself. If you have a bad stick, you are never going to get that thing filled. Versus if you're solid with your skill as far as getting an IV in and a good patent one, not backwalling it, not having it stuck up against a valve or something like that, just a good solid IV. If you can do that skill alone, you're very unlikely to have any problems. Yeah.
I don't teach the start the IV thing. I think it, while it may be easier for people who are, don't do it as often, I believe it probably is a slower draw simply because the going through a catheter, then through a needle and then into the tube. So I think it's probably slow overall, but it's potentially easier for people who don't do it often. It's an option, man. I don't try to try to tell people how to do things. I kind of just, you know, when I teach stuff, I teach it. Here's how I do it. And then here's this option.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just a technique.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the way I put it. You know, I say Andy Fisher, he does it this way. This is my technique and it's proven to be better. But
that's good.
You know, but I just put it that way and, you know, I let them choose.
Yeah. it goes your way every time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but I'm the one grading them. So, you know, so whatever I really do not care which technique somebody does as long as they're good at it.
Right, right.
If they're, you know, the last time they stuck an IV was like 6 months ago, that's a bad answer. Mm-hmm. That is the wrong answer. And especially as a skill that's so important as just an IV stick. And usually that's kind of pawned off on, you know, the lower guy, like, oh, the non-medics can do that, or, you know, whomever, somebody else can do that. I need my big brain to do this other thing. Mm-hmm. But you're putting that skill that's so important on somebody who, you know, doesn't practice very often. So I think if you are going to put the skill on those people, you have to make them practice it so that they're good at it.
Yeah, but I think it's important, though. I think it's part of success in the environment where we work and where, you know, probably your listeners work is very limited true medical people and using, you know, the people that are there with you to the non-medical people to help with these skills. And, you know, collecting a unit of blood isn't difficult, but it does take practice, like you said. And so it's kind of important that they practice and they get used to it and they can perform the skill. And that way, when it comes time, you can, you know, execute with fewest mistakes.
You know, I think it's really no different than any other skill we learn in the military. You know, I had to learn how to use a radio. I had to learn how to put my own fill in. They do expect me to clean my own weapon. I think if I can go through the effort to learn those things, they can learn some medical stuff.
Yeah.
And learn how to, you know, save somebody's life.
I mean, well, we're force multipliers for the maneuver guys, right? So we try to be force multipliers for them, being able to, we're able to shoot, we're able to, communicate. And we can still do our primary job, medicine. And I think it goes back and forth. And I don't think you'll really find a lot of pushback anywhere within in these maneuver units, soft or conventional, that wouldn't agree with that aspect. You see a lot of guys that are very willing to step up and learn a little bit of medicine in order to help, you know, everyone out.
Yes. Yeah. You know, teaching at Mountain Path, you know, I have not yet, knock on wood, run into, you know, a person who is not a medical person that, you know, actively resisted learning how to do this job, you know, how to do, you know, even basic medical things. You know, I'm not talking about, okay, you know, today we're going to learn how to drill into somebody's head. Just basic things that, you know, anybody could see that, yes, I am going to have to learn how to do that either through experience. I was asked to do that and I didn't know how, or, you know, I could easily see myself in that situation. Do you have any other things that we should put out as far as a walking blood bank?
That's a good question. I don't, trying to think that, you know, that just like everything, every time I finish up a podcast here, I always think of things that I probably should have mentioned. I think what you should have is like a 3-day grace period where we could come back and record more stuff.
Okay. Yeah, we could do that.
When I forget.
Okay.
That actually may be a good idea because I'll probably get off here and go, man.
Right. I think we covered, I mean, like you said, there's technique to everything. So we could go into the, you know, forever talking about this technique and that technique and, you know, this type of paperwork and that type of paperwork. But when it all, you know, hits the fan, it's the principles that get you through it. If you understand the principles, then you can improvise and adapt and overcome just about anything.
Yeah. 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 I agree, cool. Man. Yeah. Cool, man.
Well, thank you, Andy, very much.
Yeah. Thank you again, always. And certainly if I think of anything else that probably we should cover, I will definitely let you know.
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.